Every Saturday night on TCM, or Sunday morning if you're not a night owl, Eddie Muller introduces us to a film that usually features a bored detective, a sultry femme fatale, expressionist black and white lighting, and a hard-boiled voiceover.
Welcome to Noir Alley. I'm your host, Eddie Muller. To commemorate the Easter holiday, I'm presenting a film about a journalist who takes a daring risk to expose the dangers of capital punishment.
Eddie is the host of TCM's Noir Alley. He's also the author of Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir, and the founder and president of the Film Noir Foundation. You can see why he's known as the Czar of Noir. So we parlayed with Eddie to find out why he's an ambassador of the genre, what he considers essential viewing, and how he found his love for noir on the shadowy, steep streets of San Francisco.
I think it all had to do with my father, who was not a movie fan whatsoever, but I was born very late in his life, so he was in his prime as a young man during what we now recognize as the original noir era. And so, because I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s, the world looked entirely different then than it did only 25 years earlier. And I was just, and my dad was very much a public figure. He was a sports writer in San Francisco and was very much a wheel and a man about town. And so I, just watching him with his colleagues and seeing photographs of him in his prime, I was very much attracted to that earlier era. And then when I found the movies, it was like, well, this is the time. You know, it was almost like being able to revisit that time. And it always fascinated me to see the difference between the way my father was at home, where he was just dad, and this, essentially this character he played when he was out in public, where he was a much gruffer, tougher, hard-nosed guy. You know, the typical image of like a Damon Runyon style hard-boiled sports writer. That was my dad. But he was a different person at home. And so that also kind of fascinated me. And of course, all these characters that he hung around with, I was amazed at how deferential they were to my dad, who I knew as a sweetheart at home. But you know, these guys who I really took to be gangsters, some of them, were, you know, would curry his favor and all this kind of stuff. So all of that was fascinating to witness as well. And I think it's kind of part of how I developed this interest in noir.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first film noir you ever saw?
Well, you know, I've been asked that question enough times that I've now developed an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's absolutely true or not, I don't really know, but I say it's Thieves' Highway, which was a Fox film from 1949 with Richard Conte and Valentina Cortesa, because I like that one to be the first one because it is actually set in San Francisco.
Would they go for them in San Francisco?
They eat apples in Frisco, they ain't snobs. They'd grab them up like that.
You think Mike Figlia might be interested?
Oh, that chiseler. He'd be so crazy to get him, he might even make a straight deal.
It was a world that no longer existed when I saw the film. It was the old produce market down on the Embarcadero in San Francisco, which had long since been razed and condominiums put up. And so I was fascinated by, like, wow, there was this whole other world that existed, you know, beneath the world that we live in now. And that has always been kind of a, you know, a guiding principle of the work that I do. I'm always trying to figure out what was here right before, what led up to this, how did we get here? That's always been a fascination of mine.
Mm-hmm. What makes a film noir?
I believe the protagonists have to be compromised in some way. You know, Hollywood's job was to reassure the public. It's always been kind of a propaganda tool, right? And it's going to work out. Everything's going to end happily ever after. There was a production code that kind of enforced that whole concept. But noir, in many ways, was a resistance movement by a lot of artists to say, well, life doesn't actually work that way. And one of the ways they could do this was in genre pictures, like crime movies, in which they could show average people doing the wrong thing.
You aren't exactly the sort of a person you pretend to be, are you? I'm not sure I know exactly what you mean.
The schoolgirl manner, you know, blushing, stammering and all that.
I haven't lived a good life. I've been bad. Worse than you could know.
You know, that's good, because if you actually were as innocent as you pretend to be, we'd never get anywhere.
I won't be innocent.
Good.
Noir is where the protagonists do the wrong thing and don't have a moral awakening necessarily. Or if they do, it comes too late because they already have to pay the price for what they've done. So to me, that's kind of the essential thing. Looking at it from a writer's point of view, I mean, obviously there are those people who look at it stylistically for the iconography and the fantastic cinematography and the look of noir, which was very much of its time. Because if you were to make a noir film today, and it does happen, it wouldn't necessarily look like those movies from 1940 through the, you know, mid-50s. It would be a parody of that, and it wouldn't have the same intensity that the original films had.
Mm-hmm. You will argue that of all the different genres of film that Hollywood produced during the days of the studio system, film noirs hold up the best. Why?
Because it was that they were made during this period where the culture as a whole was losing its innocence. That was it, right? I mean, we just fought the second war to end all wars, and it was you could no longer easily mollify people and convince them that everything was going to turn out all right. It nobody was buying that, you know. So, there are other more fun reasons why noir holds up. It has a lot to do with the language, the incredibly witty vernacular speech that is so part and parcel of film noir. I mean, obviously these were beautiful films made by these incredible craftsmen that just look amazing. You don't really see a visual style associated with maybe you could argue that John Ford's Westerns have a particular visual style to them. But otherwise, no. You know, nobody talks about the visual style of screwball comedy or any, you know, musicals, of course, but that's kind of a different thing. There's just a sense, I think, that that period in American history was kind of the apex in terms of style. It was like everybody dressed so well, the cars were so fantastic, the nightclubs were the best ever, the music was fantastic, and there's a sense of people wanting to retain that spirit through these movies.
Mm-hmm. You, of course, host a show called Noir Alley on TCM, Turner Classic Movies. Tell us how that came about.
TCM and I have crossed paths a few times along the way, and we're always kind of on each other's radar. I'm pleased to say that I was personally invited by Robert Osborne to his own film festival in Athens, Georgia. He used to do this every year, and I was very gratified when Robert invited me to come and co-host some films at his festival. This was prior to any engagement with TCM. So I felt like I had gotten a benediction of sorts right off the bat. And then we started doing things with TCM, and then they just very kindly, they gave me a thing on the spotlight called The Summer of Darkness that was very, very popular. And out of that 3-month Friday night gig came the weekly show.
Mm-hmm. If someone has never heard of Noir or Noir Alley, which three films would you suggest to them as kind of a starter kit to an introduction to film noir?
I would say Double Indemnity is the essential noir title. I would say Out of the Past is definitely the Robert Mitchum Jane Greer picture from 1947.
Near the plaza was a little cafe called La Marasul, next to a movie house. I sat there in the afternoons and drank beer. I used to sit there half asleep with the beer and the darkness. Only that music from the movie next door kept jarring me awake. And then I saw her coming out of the sun. And I knew why Witt didn't care about that 40 grand.
And then after that, it's like a throw-in for depending on the person. I would say maybe Touch of Evil or maybe, you know, Kiss Me Deadly is an interesting film because it's such a 50s film. So it's sometimes good to show that to say, look, it wasn't just the 40s. There was also the 50s.
Let's talk a bit about Double Indemnity, which, as you just said, is the essential or definitive film noir, or maybe both. And on an episode of Noir Alley, when you showed Billy Wilder's film, the 1944 classic, you said that Double Indemnity screenplay revolutionized motion pictures. How did it do that?
It took two hugely popular stars. I mean, at that point, Barbara Stanwyck was the highest paid woman in the United States of America. And Fred McMurray was pretty much known just as a very light comedic actor. And it made them murderers. The audience does have empathy with those characters who are reprehensible. Those two characters are reprehensible in every way. That is a very, very subversive film. And if people now, a lot of people would watch that movie because we've had decades and decades of stories just like it, they may not understand just how groundbreaking that film was to put two big stars in a movie where they are such wretched characters and to somehow make them charismatic and appealing so that when they're committing the crime and the car doesn't start when they're trying to get away from the rail yard, you're rooting for the car to start. You know, you don't want them to get caught. And that's very, very sophisticated and like I say, groundbreaking stuff for what, you know, it's not every movie that brings up these issues and then makes you confront yourself. Like, Why did I want them to get away with it?
What does that mean?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Well, the film, of course, is based on the novel by James M. Cain, and Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler wrote the screenplay together. What changes did Wilder and Chandler make? What were the biggest changes they made to Cain's novel?
They made the language sing. James M. Cain was incredibly important figure in the development of noir on the page because his books were like tailor-made for the movies. They were short, they were punchy, they had a real sleazy vibe to them that would be part of this whole watershed moment in cinema history. But he didn't write good dialogue. It, as Chandler said, it just laid there on the page. There was nothing to it. And man, I mean, Billy Wilder is one of the greatest screenwriters of all time, and Chandler had a way with language second to none. So that was basically the biggest change in my estimation was the words they put in the mouths of the characters were very different than what Cain had written and just beautiful.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head in your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it.
I sometimes go into schools, and that's the scene I always show them. The scene where Fred McMurray and Stanwyck meet in Double Indemnity, because then I show it, they laugh at it, and then it opens up all this discussion about, so what's really going on in this scene? What do you think his motivations really are, and what's she all about? And all, and the kids get it completely, but I'm able to explain, well, you know, this is how they had to do it once upon a time, because for all those reasons we talked about earlier, right? I mean, the production code would not allow certain things to be shown or even discussed, and that scene has so much innuendo that it's a great primer for young people to understand how movie makers had to operate back then.
How has being the czar of noir and a noir archaeologist affected the way you view your life and the world in which we live?
I think people might be surprised at what a relentlessly optimistic person I am in terms of my own life and things, you know. Mm-hmm. Noir has served me very well. I appreciate it very, very much. And I will say this, this may be a sideways way of answering your question, but it has been incredibly gratifying over these 20 or so years, because once I started doing the film festivals, when I created the Film Noir Foundation to restore movies and all this stuff, it has been so gratifying that noir, which is all about disillusionment and alienation and the worst instincts in people, has opened up this gigantic world, which is completely international, of people who share these same interests as me. And we now have this network of people all over the world who are looking for noir films and, you know, coming to the festivals, and it's been amazing. I'm not going to say it's a cult or anything, but it's a wonderful fraternity of people. It's not even a fraternity, because it's total gender split, right? Mm-hmm. It is men and women equally who love this stuff.
Yeah. Eddie Muller, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Eddie Muller is the czar of noir. He's the host of TCM's Noir Alley and the author of Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir. Find out more about Eddie and film noir at WPR.org/beta.
You can make a drive you make all the time, and your GPS connection breaks, and then you suddenly are like, wait, what exit do I take? Like, how do I do this?
Ruman Alam joins us to talk about his strangely resonant suspense novel, Leave the World Behind. That's coming up in just a moment. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.